Welcome to this Security Serengeti. We're your host, Davis Meyer and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome 5-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application that you can take in the office to help you protect your organization. Or maybe we'll just talk about something cool we saw.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
In the latest reporting news, the Indian government now requires used Trojans to be reported within 6 hours. As a side note, I added something cool we saw because I was thinking about it. And we do try and get articles that are useful for business, but I feel like we've been drifting more and more into the cool thing we saw lately.
Yeah, or whatever is going to cause us to start ranting about something.
That one is also, that's usually a good choice.
All right, speaking of ranting.
Nice segue.
First article is, the UK's bad encryption law can't withstand global contempt. And the subheadline is, any sufficiently stupid technology is indistinguishable from magical thinking.
And surprise, it's from
The Register, of course.
I noticed this whole episode is actually from The Register.
Really? The whole thing?
I'm thinking
maybe we should change our podcast to The Register.
The Register, like fan readings or something.
There used to be, there was the, you know, Bruce Schneier does the cryptogram, and this guy named Dan Hinnich used to read it. Cast stopped. So, and it was just called the Cryptogram newsletter. So it's kind of frustrating for me because I usually don't get around to finishing it because as of late, the cryptograms have been like really long. But anyway, so this is an opinion piece about the UK's online safety bill, and it's portrayed in light of two other news articles about the US government behaving badly. And this is by Rupert Goodwins. And you can tell by that
name.
Yeah, you can tell that's a very British name.
Rupert.
So the two articles that he references to put this in context is the first one about the Secret Service and immigration officers caught using fake cell towers, commonly known as stingrays, to intercept communications without a warrant. You know, shocking.
And so, correct, how do those work? Those are the ones where you kind of set it up and it intercepts and pulls all cell phones within a certain radius to you and uses you as your cell phone tower?
Right. I can't remember. I think there's something specifically in the way it does it, that it shows up as like a new cell tower with lower latency or something like that, which makes it preferential for your phone to go to. I think that's how it works. I actually did not look it up prior to this, but that's what I recall at the time when this thing first came to light, like 10 years ago, I want to say, is when the stingrays first were brought into focus.
Gotcha.
But this whole thing is probably taking place within the 100-mile constitutional free border zone. And there'll be a link in the show notes to a complaint by the ACLU about the search and seizure activity that the Border Patrol does within 100 miles of the border without warrant.
Yeah, because they don't have to follow constitutional protections, right?
Well, they claim they don't have to within 100 miles of the border. And the other article is FBI's child abuse unit being hacked. And what I thought was interesting about this one was a quote from a former FBI agent that worked in this division of the FBI, who said, most likely an infected device was seized, collected, and then infected the FBI forensics computer after evading malware scans.
That is so interesting. That sounds like a flipping like plot from one of these like, you know, cop shows or whatever, where they see something and then the bad guy's like secretly like, yes, plug it into your network.
I dare ya.
Yeah.
Right. And I didn't write it down here, but this agent said that most likely it only infected the forensic network. So they've got a separate network that's for forensics. Yeah, that network is what got compromised. But the way that he also said it was that it didn't get onto the classified network. I was like, well, the classified network would obviously be separate from the unclassified network. That doesn't necessarily make the forensic network separate from the rest of the unclassified FBI
network. Or what about the internet? Like, would it still be able to exfiltrate data? Because you'd think that the forensic network would be air-gapped.
I mean, maybe outside of the government it would be. These, you know, I don't have a lot of faith in their ability to do anything right. So in light of those two stories is the way that he's kind of framed the rest of his opinion piece here about the UK online safety bill, which of course is designed to protect the children.
Always protect the children.
Which is in effect to put backdoors into all end-to-end encryption.
That seems perfectly safe. We can trust the government with the encryption keys. And this has never come back and bit anybody in the butt before.
No.
No company has ever put a deliberate backdoor in their software and had that taken advantage of.
Or putting a rootkit on a CD.
Calling out Sony. Like, I wouldn't call it out anybody. And you're just like, bam.
Yeah, they'll get over it. But to quote from the bill, it imposes duties of care on providers of user-to-user service and search services. And the definition of user-to-user service means an internet service by means of which content that is generated directly on the service by a user of the device or uploaded to or shared on the service by a user of the service may be encountered by another user or other users of the service.
That is incredibly broad, because I'm thinking, so I just updated my Photoshop. Like, I'm signed up for Adobe service. I'm pretty sure they have because every service is built in social media stuff. So like, does that mean that Adobe Creative thing has to build in a backdoor? I mean,
I would think so, because it goes on to say, it does not matter if the content is actually shared with another user or users, as long as that service has a functionality that allows sharing.
So this is just a backdoor into the encryption, not a backdoor into the computer. They don't have to provide.
Well, it's a backdoor into all the contents on the computer, though, because this is effectively device-side scanning of the entire contents of the computer. If it's to be, because the backdoor's got to reside somewhere. So it's got to reside on the local device.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to think. Like, how would you put a backdoor into the backdoor in the encryption? Is it just like the key that they have available to them, or is it an actual backdoor? Maybe I just don't like their use of backdoor here.
Well, they don't get into implementation, because they're going to leave it up to, the assumption would be anyway, that the government is going to leave it up to the provider of the service to design the backdoor, or however you want to categorize it.
All right. So as long as it has sharing, as long as there's some way that content
could be shared,
generated, uploaded, or shared.
Right. So in other words, you know, let's say you're using your Adobe product, right? And it's got a sharing capability on it. It doesn't matter if you ever intend to share anything within that product with anybody. Simply the fact that it has that capability means that they will scan anything you produce with it.
Yeah, because if it's something like Facebook, like all the content is stored on servers. So that just means that they would be able to access and scan all the content on the servers. Yeah, I was just wondering more about
that. No, but this specifically calls out user to user, which means end-to-end encryption must be compromised.
Gotcha. Yeah, the decentralized stuff would have to be incorporated in this. Huh. Yeah, because I run a Mastodon instance, so I would have to comply with this somehow if I had any users in the UK. This almost seems like another, what's the word for it? I don't know what the word for it is. When big companies and like sponsor bills that make it harder for individuals and smaller companies to follow them so that the big companies can get a larger share. Is that rent seeking? That's not rent seeking. That's something else. So, because if something like this passed, I would just have to, if anybody from the UK wanted to join my Mastodon instance, I'd have to be like, sorry, you can't. Or I'd, you know, risk the UK coming in and being all, hey, give us the encryption keys for your server, for your communications.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's a specific term for that, but it's either way, it's raising the barrier to entry in the market to stay in the market.
Yeah, because it's not enough. You're right, though. It's not enough to just give them the encryption keys. Because if you just gave them the encryption keys, then they'd have to capture it on the wire. They need to be able to access it on the server or on the host, as well as the encryption.
Right.
Yeah. All right. I'll shut up for a while.
Because like I said, it doesn't matter that you don't even have to transmit it and it will be scanned. But this is before the UK Parliament right now. It hasn't gone through the entire process yet. It's finished going through the House of Commons, which is the first part. And now it's in committee in the House of Lords. And the committee portion of the workflow in the House of Lords is halfway. So it's about two-thirds of the way through the process of being ratified in the UK. And at least as of now, Signal and WhatsApp have both said they will leave the UK market if this law goes into effect. They will not alter their software to comply.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I imagine that Telegram as well probably would have trouble with this too. They'll probably have to leave as well because they're big on privacy and not giving up their keys.
Well, we'll see what they say.
Yeah.
But only so far, at least what I've read, only Signal and WhatsApp have categorically come out and said, you know, we're going to leave if this happens.
Yeah. I have to imagine that what's really going to happen here is that pretty much every application that can is just going to say, all right, well, we're not, if you're from the UK, you don't get to use our service.
Yeah, I'm sure you get plenty of that.
Mm. All right.
But I think this also means that all VPNs will have to have this backdoor in it.
Oof. Yeah, because something could
be shared across it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Because my expectation would be that, you know, the government will interpret it as broadly as they feel they want to or need to include VPN, even though it may not seem that's included.
Yeah, because you could, you know, turn on file sharing on your system or, you know, go to a file transfer site or something on the VPN. Oh, boy. This is worse than I thought when we originally discussed it, honestly.
Yeah. So what Rupert suggests to be done about it is we must use end-to-end encryption ourselves at every opportunity.
Good old Rupert.
And that, you know, I've been saying this for a while that, you know, everything needs to be encrypted all the time. Yeah. You know, all data in motion, all data at rest needs to be encrypted. You know, because the technical and financial cost of encryption now is so low, there's really not much of an excuse for encryption not to be ubiquitous now. And even if the encryption's not great, it still does raise the bar for interception and collection.
At least until quantum is out.
Yeah, that's right around the corner. It's funny, in an article we'll talk about later, it's mentioning that an organization had gotten an award for quantum crypto and quantum crypto innovation in 2010. So Rupert goes on to say, the UK cannot be allowed to have even the smallest apparent success in breaking user security, as other countries will surely follow. The urge of the state to snoop on its citizens is as universal as it is corrosive.
I like Rupert.
Yeah, I can get along with him. But this is why this matters. This is very troubling, to say the least. And to quote the article, it goes beyond also child exploitation, which is what they mentioned as
which
the primary
everyone is against.
This.
Nobody is for that, except for, you know, the perverts.
Except for exploiters.
Yeah. But I hate that they use this as a Trojan horse, because nobody's willing to come out and say, I'm against this, because it allows them to be like, oh, well, you must be for, no, we're effing not.
Yeah, well, that just goes to the disingenuous part of the entire discussion. But as I was saying, that this goes beyond simple child exploitation as they categorize it, because to quote the actual bill, it says, a person commits an offense if the message conveys information that the person knows to be false. So what's that got to do with child exploitation?
Yeah, I was actually a little confused about this when you added this in here. I thought we were talking about child exploitation stuff, and this is not seemingly related. So this is all packed under the same law.
Yeah, this is in the, I downloaded the PDF for the bill, and that's in there. It lists like four things that have to be true for it to be an offense. But none of those four things have anything to do with child exploitation. But it centers around making false statements that hurt someone's feelings that's a slight exaggeration. But
it says non-trivial psychological harm. How do you define non-trivial? Like, obviously, you know, driving somebody to potential suicide is non-trivial. But is that what they're going to use it for? I saw a video the other day. This guy was doing kind of a troll protest on a campus. He had posted signs saying, are there two genders? Do you agree or disagree? And people would walk up to him, and he was doing an epistemological thing where he was trying to get people to think about the things that they think they know. And why I say he was doing it in a trolly way is he could have picked something that was much less controversial. He picked a very controversial subject on purpose. But this group of people walked up to him and told him that he was harming people because one of their friends saw him and had to leave the campus because they were triggered. And like there were people on top of a nearby building flicking him off and shouting cuss words at him. And this dude was super polite to everybody. He was very respectful. Again, I say he was a little trolly because he picked something deliberately to piss people off.
Right.
But like when people came and talked to him, he was super respectful about it. He was like, we can do something else. Like, I just want to get you to think about why you believe. And it was interesting. It's an interesting video.
Yeah. America's no longer the land of the free, home of the brave. But yeah, just snowflakes.
We're pretty free. They're just a lot more.
We can talk in relative terms, right? I'm not. Yep. I don't entirely agree with that.
That's not what the podcast is about anyways.
But as I'm saying, they're trying to shoehorn a lot more in here, hiding behind the child exploitation thing, which they're leading with for this whole thing. And this kind of gets into the whole disinformation, misinformation thing that the United States had that the Tooth office in the DHS about, which got shut down for the moment. But this is just the beginning. If you pay attention to this kind of stuff, you usually see it in the UK first, and then it jumps across the pond and you end up seeing it over in the United States as well. So if this comes to pass in the UK, you can expect the United States government to try the similar tactic on this end after the UK has tested the waters and seen that they were able to get this through. And what you can do about it is use encryption as much as you can for everything. Yeah, even if you don't need it. You should just encrypt all the things.
That's fair. And you should call, write, and tell your congressman because, as George Carlin says, even in a fake democracy, people ought to get what they want once in a while. You make enough noise, then they do frequently listen to people if you make enough noise and get riled up enough about it.
Yeah, supposedly 50 phone calls is enough, but I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical that it makes a difference. I mean, you could say that the number of people that are protesting against the Ukraine war and the different governments throughout Europe don't seem to be making a dent in the way things going on, so.
All right. For our second article, it's more governments behaving badly, also from the Register. India's absurd InfoSec reporting rules get just 15 followers. India's rules requiring local organizations to report InfoSec incidents within 6 hours of detection have been observed by a mere 15 entities. We talked about this last year, I'm pretty sure, right?
Yeah, episode 58.
Look at you on top of that. Just that was by memory, right? You just remembered.
Of course not. I had to look it up. Oh, but this came out in April of 2022.
April 2022. India's rules requiring local... Did I say that? I already said that, didn't I?
Yeah. Damn it. All India right. delayed.
All right. So India did delay the deadline for small and medium businesses to comply. And the Register has received... This is a quote. The Register has received no response to multiple inquiries regarding how it would ingest and analyze the flood of reports its rules would generate and therefore how they would represent useful intelligence because they will accept faxed reports.
I can imagine that's going to get data-based.
Yeah. Cloud providers also pushed back as the rules required them to submit logs generated by their customer servers, which cloud providers are not supposed to have access to the server-level logs. So that would be awkward.
Right. And where they're getting the 15 number from is in 2021 and 2022, around 1.4 million attacks were recorded in each of those years in India.
Wow.
Yeah, so that comes out to be, you know, about 700,000 or so reported after the rule went into effect. But of those 700,000, only 15 people actually reported it within the six-hour deadline. Or 15 organizations reported within the six-hour deadline.
Yep, and even with this obvious failure, they have not backed away from the requirement. So this is, of course, typical for how the government handles failure. It's somebody else's fault, not theirs. And as you mentioned before, this could be coming here. The U.S. has laid some groundwork for it already, Cyber Incident Reporting for Critical Infrastructure Act. Do you know offhand what the reporting requirement for that is?
No, but if you go back and listen to episode 58, we did talk about it quite a bit in that one.
Gotcha. Yeah, this is the one where you have to report it to CISA. Although it does say it's voluntary sharing. Encourages all organizations to share information about unusual cyber activity and or cyber incidents. Via report at CISA.gov or a phone number. Ah, boy.
Yep. So take copious notes when you call them. So call up with a string of like a dozen IP addresses and some file hashes.
Yeah, this one kept hitting us over and over. 192.168.1.213. That one's a bad one. You should block it everywhere. All right. Or 127 does 0.1. That one's really bad.
No, that is the worst.
Block it everywhere at the host level.
Right. Yeah. Best implemented in a host-based firewall.
So what should you do about it? Stay on the lookout for this kind of thing. People at the government level, this is the same. This is really the same as the other one. Like, they don't have the technical knowledge. They're doing this from what looks good to constituents and what keeps them with the money coming from the lobbying companies and what allows them to say that they are doing something.
Oh, I mean, what allows them to accumulate power. I mean, you're talking about a bunch of lawyers. I mean, virtually all, you know, Congress is filled with lawyers, and most of them have not held out a real job. You know, yeah. They have no understanding about these things that they're passing these laws for. No clue at all. I mean, the original idea was that you're going to get a swath of professions within the Congress,
they're
not
to
all
come to
lawyers.
Congress for a brief period of time, right? Like, it was, you came in and served a thing or two, and then you went back home.
Right. Well, the expectation was that you were going to only be in the government, you know, in D.C. for a couple of months a year or something like that. The rest of that time you would spend back in your district or in your state. But we've fallen a long way from that, which brings us to our last article, which is, you've been pawned. Now, how much will each stolen customer end cost you? How about
$1 million? So.
Yeah. Not quite. How about $750? I'm sorry, $7,500.
I mean, $750 is still a bit more than it probably.
Well, with inflation, that and another $750 will get you a Coke.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
All right. So the Orlando family physicians who run 10 clinics in Central Florida settled a class action lawsuit where the victims will get 2 years of credit monitoring, you know, which is awesome. I don't even know why they need anything beyond that, to be honest, but you know.
Yeah, let's just settle it.
I get this other stuff. $225 in documented expenses if you paid out of pocket for anything related to the breach. And $7,500 if the attacker stole your social security number and you can prove that it was used for identity theft.
Which means nobody's going to get paid out anything on that.
No, highly unlikely.
So I did see in a 2016 report, David mentioned this when we were talking the other day, so I went and tried to look up the source. David was talking about how these things are only, social security numbers are only worth like a dollar. And I went and I checked it out, and there's a report from 2016 that says that you can buy a social security number for a dollar on the internet. So I think $7,500 is a lot for that.
But, well, it's going to cost you probably more than that to deal with the effects of identity theft, though. So if they give you the $7,500, according to a report from the Sands Institute, it's going to take an average of 6 months and roughly 200 hours to recover from having your identity stolen. You know, so in Florida, at the minimum wage of Florida, which is $12, that right there is $2,400.
That's interesting.
But like I said, that's if it's minimum wage, assuming that it takes you 200 hours and there are other expenses relating to the identity theft. One article I read while looking in it said, you know, if a criminal conducts a criminal, you know, takes your identity and then performs fraud with it, you might end up being on the hook, assume that you committed the fraud, and they might come up to you from a criminal perspective as well, which when then you're talking about additional legal fees and everything. That $7,500 wouldn't even cover, you know, the lawyer for a week in dealing with the criminal outcomes of something like that.
That is such a weird value mismatch. It's so strange that something that's only worth a dollar on the dark web can cost you so much trouble.
Right. Well, originally when they came out with the social security number, they said, well, this is not going to be used for identification.
Well, that was silly.
But they had no idea at the time, you know, what the welfare state was going to turn into. But the number of victims as part of this lawsuit was 447,000. And this organization, the Orlando Family Physicians, runs 10 clinics. And that seems like a lot of victims for only 10 clinics.
Yeah, that's 47,000 per clinic. I mean, maybe that's why I can't get in and get an appointment at my doctor anymore.
It could be. So I don't know if they're hoarding data or what. So I looked into what the data retention requirements are for healthcare. And according to the Florida Admin Code 64B8-10, from 2008, they were required to maintain the record for 5 years after the last patient contact. And if it's a public hospital, they're required for 7 years after the last entry. Now, if this was relating to the Veterans Administration, the VA patient locator file is required to be stored for 75 years after the last episode of care or after the perpetual record is destroyed. And the patient locator file is a locator card containing basic identification for each patient. The file includes patient's name, social security number, home address, treatment status, medical record file location, and other identification data.
Yeah, everything wants your damn social security.
So this was related to the VA. They'd be required to keep it even longer. And they indicated that this compromise occurred because four employees had their email compromised. So I guess they want some redundancy there.
Shocked, I tell you. I'm actually kind of surprised. I don't think they gave any detail about how this phishing attack led to all these 447,000 records. I don't think it mentioned anything about whether they like got into their system or if this data was in the email or what.
I don't know. That's what I was wondering as well, is they must have had been able to prove negligence in some way in order to get the payout, I would think.
Well, I mean, having 447,000 records accessible via email would be pretty negligent.
Right. But I mean, phishing is typically used, you know, and then pivoted, you know, via some other way. So that's just the foothold. I'm not sure if that's, you know, they did just pull it out of email. It's certainly possible, but I'm not sure. But they must have had to show negligence in some way to get this kind of payout.
So if you read the PDF for the settlement, it says that the 10 locations served more than 100,000 patients. So that's a mismatch with the 447. Then it says an unauthorized actor accessed four email accounts through a phishing scam, posted a notice, began notifying people. So maybe they don't know. I mean, it does. The exposed PII and PHI of the defendant's current and former patients can be sold on the dark web. Yeah, unfortunately, this does not say.
Kind of sounds like they folded early then, and they didn't even prove negligence.
It sounds like they didn't even prove that it was stolen, like necessarily, because they haven't validated that it's for sale anywhere online. They give no details whatsoever about how it was accessed or what the attackers did other than access those four accounts. That's interesting.
So it sounds like it's all assumption then.
Oh, here we go. There's a section on the security incident. Prior to the security incident, oh, interesting. All right, so here they're saying what they should have done. They should have, one, encrypted or tokenized the sensitive PI or PHI. So apparently it wasn't encrypted. Deleted the PI that it no longer had reason to maintain. So you were talking about the law before it, how that has to be maintained for 5 years or 7 years. I'm betting they had longer records than that.
Mm-hmm.
Eliminate the potential accessibility of the PI from the internet and otherwise review or improve the security of its email system. That's a weird one because phishing usually doesn't involve the security of the email system.
Right. Well, unless they're talking about prevention to detect possible phishes and stop them. But I mean, that's hard to do.
We identified three and began an extensive review. We terminated the access in more than 24 hours. The attacker only had access for the same 24 hours of the initial unauthorized access. Yeah, oh, okay. OFP discovered that there may have been unauthorized access to personal information contained in the four email accounts. So this just seems like terrible data hygiene. If there were 400,000 accounts available.
Well, that seems to indicate that they were emailing unencrypted
files back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah. If it was in the PST or whatever, and they just pulled that out of there.
Yeah. So I would agree. This is pretty flippant negligent.
Yeah.
All right. So I have a couple questions here. Is this any kind of win for the people suing? Is it going to change anything? Like you said, it may cost them more than $7,500 in time and money to fix an issue. And you have to prove that you lost it because of this actual event.
It may do something to force that one organization to improve its security a little bit anyway, but I think that's about it. The 447,000 people, this doesn't help them really much at all.
Yay.
But as usual, the ones who make out for any class action lawsuits are the lawyers. So I'm not sure what they paid out here, but to give an example, the Exxon Valdez oil spill case, which happened in 89. Well, the event happened in 89, but the lawsuit ended in 1994. So the award for that suit in 94 was $5 billion. But by the time they got through all the legal rulings and shenanigans, the Supreme Court knocked it down in 2008 to $500 million. And according to one legal site that I read, this supposedly with interest meant the total award was $1.5 billion. I wasn't able to find that number anywhere else, so I'm not sure exactly how that works out. So we'll stick with $500 million. So that said, that there was supposed to be 32,000 people involved in that lawsuit, which means that according to statements from the legal team, each of those 32,000 people got approximately $15,000, which comes out to be $480 million, which means the lawyers got $20 million. And if it was the $1.5 billion, that means the lawyers would have gotten $60,000 and the people would have gotten somewhere around $45,000. So a slight price mismatch there between what the lawyers got and what the people who were actually party to the suit got.
$20 million. Man, should have done what my mom said and been a lawyer. So my other question here is, would this actually change behavior if they gave each person $7,500?
If the 447,000 people all got $7,500, regardless of whether there was a identity theft or not?
Yeah. Actually, I guess I can figure this out myself.
Like, they probably just would have gone bankrupt and just closed the doors, which would have been, you know, no change in their behavior at all.
447,000. That is a lot of zeros. That is millions. Yeah, that's $3.352 billion. So,
yeah. So I'm pretty sure that company would have simply gone out of business.
And nobody would have gotten anything. So it'd be about the same as it is now.
It would have changed their behavior because they'd be on the street corner, but actually wouldn't improve anybody's data security.
I don't know, though, like if it was a real risk, because that's something we've talked about over and over again. Like, you know, Target got hacked. You know, this is it. The company's going under. SolarWinds got hacked. This is it. The company's going under. Like, it's happened occasionally with small companies that haven't been able to fund it, but like no big company's really been seriously hurt except for SolarWinds.
Well, I was going to say, what's SolarWinds stock price at now? I should check this every month or so.
Are you checking it or are we moving on?
Yeah, I'm checking. Yeah. So it's $8.37 as of right now.
So you're saying I should buy some SolarWinds stock. I could afford to buy the whole company.
Well, I'm at Yahoo Finance. So it says $8.37. And they have this little thing down here that's a slider, talks about whether it's adequately valued or not. And it says it's way overvalued.
It's still overvalued. $8.
And the outlook performance in the short term, midterm, and long term are all down. So yeah, I'm not sure. And if we go back up to the peak before the event, we're talking about $24. So it's still down by 2/3.
But it's not destroyed. Like the company's still there. They're still doing stuff.
Yeah, they are. But we'll see. I was fairly certain they were going to go bankrupt from this, but they haven't yet.
Fair enough.
All right. Well, that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us, and follow us at Serengeti Tech on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.